We are talking once again with Job Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. No Maria this week. Our fingers are crossed she'll be back next week.
Yes. And nothing much happened this week.
Yeah, that's pretty much the – we're carrying over a theme from 2020 into 2021.
Pretty much. And 2019 and 2018, yeah.
So, starting out with local and those texts, missing texts we touched on last week.
Yes. Well, we found out this week, supposedly, why those texts were missing. Jenny Durkin's office said that she had her phone set to automatically delete texts after 30 days, which, of course, is a huge problem since they're public texts and they need to be archived. And it wasn't just Durkin who deleted her texts from last summer during the height of the George Floyd protests and the autonomous zone and CHOP and all the rest of that. So did Carmen Best, who was then chief of police. So did four of Carmen Best's, chief, minions or leaders within SPD. And it raises the question of how did those six leaders know to set their texts on delete? I mean, you know, I have a smartphone and I don't know how to do it. You know, somebody had to go deep within and know how to set those settings. And why did they set those settings? And whose idea was it? My suspicion is that the idea originated within SPD rather than Durkin's office, because SPD usually tells Durkin what to do, apparently. And the culture of non-accountability within SPD runs deep. But it really emphasizes the total lack of accountability within SPD and the command structure, up to and including the mayor of Seattle, when the discussions of how to handle those protests were being done. We also found out this week in a Seattle Times report that something that we already knew anecdotally, that the response times on Capitol Hill and the area around the autonomous zone were up dramatically, especially even for serious crimes. And this is something that was used by SPD as an intentional campaign to slime the autonomous zone. And it worked, because we had several shootings that were not within the autonomous zone but were around the edges of it. And a couple of people died because the police and fire response, the 911 response, was slowed or non-existent, so that people actually had to take folks to the emergency room in private vehicles, which is all kinds of problematic. And as I said, a couple people later died from quite possibly the delay in getting them serious medical care. So the response times were down. It seemed to be an intentional campaign by SPD to deny service to people in the area in and immediately around the autonomous zone. And the question again is, whose idea was that? How was that decision made? We don't really know anything about the command structure or those decisions, and that's where those texts might have been very helpful. But they have been deleted, at least according to the mayor's office and according to spokespeople for Best, who has gone on to a lucrative consulting and media career after her quote-unquote retirement last fall. There's still a lot we don't know. And coming up in about a week and a half, we have the anniversary of George Floyd's murder. And I'm sure there are going to be major protests, not only in Seattle, but around the country and actually probably around the world to commemorate that anniversary. And, are likely to have, more bad police shootings this summer and more protests. And we'll just have to see how SPD handles those protests going forward. If earlier this year has been any indication, it's not any improvement over 2020.
From my readings, it appears that when you become a official Seattle city, well, not employee, but working in administrations, like in City Hall, you literally go through a training that teaches you to set your phones, your devices, so that it doesn't delete things. I mean, you would have to physically go in and change the settings of the phones you receive, and basically go right against the training that wouldn't surprise me if you had to like sign it on the dotted line at the bottom of the page.
Yeah, and every Seattle employee, and when I worked for a city council person, this was true, and I went through it. Every city employee is taught to to save, not to delete any records, and that they belong to the public, and you have to preserve them. I didn't get the phone training. Maybe that's the leadership that gets city cell phones, but that ethic applies to every city employee. And so, people like Carmen Best, who has literally spent her entire career as a city employee within SPD, would know that very well. And same for the other police leadership, that they get those trainings periodically. It's not just when you onboard. So somebody had to go directly against that training. Absolutely.
Yeah. The other thing that was interesting in the group of people that have so far been identified as deleting texts was the inclusion of Seattle Fire Department Chief Harold Scoggins.
Yes.
For the reason of that, traditionally the fire department has been way more progressive in its involvement in politics or lack thereof.
Yeah.
But he would obviously be a key person that would be communicating on any major issues that were surrounding CHOP .
Well, and the 911 response time. I mean, obviously that involves the fire department and paramedics as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So, yeah, this is a real sticky one.
And one of the things that happened with some of those shootings last summer was the paramedics would be called to the scene, but they wouldn't want to go in without a police escort, which is standard practice is in a crowd situation. And then the police wouldn't give them the escort, and so the paramedics would never arrive, which is, again, something that the text might have helped illuminate.
Yeah. So.
It stinks of a cover-up, honestly. It really does.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But let's just be explicit about it. So anyway, yeah.
All right. So moving on.
That's our liberal Seattle leadership for you.
Yeah. Speaking of leadership and potential changes there, further election news this week?
Yeah. Well, in terms of mayor, there will be a change there next year because Jenny Durkin is thankfully not running for reelection. We had a 20th mayoral candidate jumped in the race this week, a guy named Art Langtree, who is the grandson of a former mayor and governor, a factoid that the Seattle Times chose to play up in its coverage. And frankly, I think the Seattle Times is about the only people who think that that's relevant now, that kind of heritage, other than maybe explaining Mr. Langtree's sense of entitlement. But he is a business owner, has no private, no public service experience, certainly no experience running a political campaign. And he is, by my count, the sixth or seventh person trying to appeal to the business community for support, seriously, in a mayoral run. Of course, Colleen Echohawk is lapping the field in terms of fundraising from that demographic. But you also have Bruce Harrell, you have Jason Farrell, you have, you know, just a whole bunch of people who have jumped in the race. Whereas you only have one person really running a grassroots campaign that is you know, focused on democracy vouchers and small donations. So the filing deadline is next Friday, May 21st. At that point, the field for the August primary will be set. The top two finishers in the primary, of course, go on to the general election in November. So we will spend a fair amount of time next week, and I'm sure Maria will chime in on this also, going over who's going to be on the ballot, how they're doing in fundraising so far, and just sort of handicapping the field in terms of who stands for what or doesn't stand for things, as the case may be.
Which will be entertaining and fun to a degree as the mayoral debates and events begin. I think actually some of them starting next week, but certainly
yes,
as we get to the end of May.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there are forums, there's endorsements, all sorts of things coming up.
Yeah.
So the election season will begin for real starting next week.
All right. Anything else on that? Or
nope, let's move on.
Let's talk about this week's developments with the pandemic.
Yeah, well, the main developments this week were national. Washington State very quickly adopted the changed CDC guidelines. And there were a couple major ones this week. Pfizer was authorized, their vaccine was authorized for use in 12 to 15-year-olds, which is the youngest eligibility for vaccine. So Washington State adjusted its guidelines so that 12 to 15-year-olds are now eligible for the Pfizer vaccine. And then, of course, the bombshell on Thursday, which the CDC surprised a lot of epidemiologists by saying, well, you know, if you're vaccinated, you can ditch the masks. Don't worry about it. In most circumstances, there are a few circumstances where you can't, public transportation of all kinds, whether that be planes or buses or whatever, light rail, you still have to wear a mask, according to the CDC. And, there's a number of problems with this guidance, as many people have noted, myself included, almost immediately after this came out. Let's start with the fact that this is supposed to be an incentive for people who haven't been vaccinated to go get vaccinated. But what it really works out to, if you are at all a student of human nature, is it's an incentive for people to lie about whether they have been vaccinated. And you are putting pretty much anybody who works in a service industry in the awkward position of having to judge whether that guy down at the end of the bar without a mask has been vaccinated or not. It puts businesses in the awkward position of having to decide whether to enforce mask mandates. And some of the nation's biggest retailers are pretty much split down the middle in terms of whether to do this. Some retailers like Costco comes to mind, Walmart. I'm drawing a blank on a couple of the other ones, have decided to drop their mask mandates. Others like Target have decided to keep their mask mandates. And, you know, it puts store personnel in businesses that have decided to keep the mask mandate in the awkward position of trying to enforce it. And it has probably informed the decision of some of those retailers who are dropping the mask mandate to do so because they don't want to put their personnel in that kind of awkward position. That constellation of problems is one set of problems with the CDC guidelines. Another set of problems is that it's not clear what office buildings, schools, some other settings like that should do. The CDC says it will come out with more place-specific guidelines next week. So hopefully we'll get some clarification on that. And then finally, there are a bunch of people who haven't been able to take the vaccine, that it puts at greater risk. That includes immunocompromised people, immunosuppressed people, of which there are millions in the United States. And I happen to be one. My partner happens to be another. Kids under the age of 12 that have not been able to get vaccinated, no fault of their own. The problem with immunocompromised people, of course, is that their immune systems don't work properly, so that they may have been fully vaccinated, but the vaccines don't necessarily work, and we don't know. The science is very unclear on that. It suggests that there may be some efficacy, but it's not full efficacy. So, you know, it's those folks need to keep wearing masks. And kids under the age of 12 probably need to keep wearing masks. Because you don't know who has and who hasn't been vaccinated among other people who are not wearing masks. And that is the number one thing you can do to protect yourself against this virus, which is airborne. There's a fascinating article out this morning in Wired that goes through the sort of forensic epidemiology of how people figured out that this was an airborne disease. Do you remember at the beginning of the pandemic, people were talking about, oh, you got to wash your hands, you got to clean surfaces. Well, no, it doesn't really spread that way. It spreads almost entirely through airborne transmission. And that was a serious piece of detective work, done by, I forget the name of the specialty, but people who study how atmosphere works and how disease gets transmitted. It was kind of remarkable the way science kicked in and identified very quickly the virus, how the virus spreads, and of course the development of the vaccine. Even as the leadership of the United States was seriously anti-science, and we'll talk about the asylum or the political party known as the Republican Party in a little bit here, so that's the CDC's guidelines. Personally, I'm gonna keep wearing a mask, and I think other people should too, because not only does it protect you. Not only does it protect other people, flu transmission was way down this winter, by the way, because people were wearing masks. So that was a side benefit. But, it also gives other people peace of mind that you're not spreading the disease. It's a small price to pay, I think. I had somebody ask me yesterday, so are you and your partner going to go to the beach this weekend? And to which I immediately replied, oh, hell no. it's a lovely, lovely weekend. Get out and play, but get out and play outdoors, away from others. That's my best advice.
As a member of a immunocompromised household, how, have you both fared getting your shots?
I had no reaction at all to either shot. Which is kind of disturbing because it may mean that my body wasn't producing antibodies and I'm not protected at all. My partner had no problems with the first shot and was sick as a dog for a week and a half with the second shot. She had Pfizer, I had Moderna, so go figure. And I've heard from a lot of people who had trouble with the second Pfizer shot. So, for people who are about to get the second shot, thank you. And be prepared that it may take you out for a few days. You'll just feel sick. It will pass, but it's not pleasant for a while.
Yeah, when the White House notice came out the end of this week, basically repeating what CDC said. I mean, my first reaction was, oh my God, it's a notice from the former Trump administration piece of the CDC that somehow got like caught up in like a mail server for like, you know, what, 6-9 months since they were in control.
Well, yeah. Remember, Trump was really pushing to open everything by May 1st in 2020. How'd that work out? So yeah, maybe they just reset it for a year.
Yeah. Anyway, I just was. You just felt like you're on what planet are we on?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the other thing I want to talk about this week in terms of COVID updates is we're starting to get really alarming data about the Indian variant, which of course has blown away India over the past couple of months. But it is now spread to Southeast Asia. And so almost every country in Southeast Asia, and that region had really done remarkably well compared to any other part of the planet, in battling the pandemic. You know, you had countries like Vietnam who literally had no deaths at all in a country of 100 million people. So Vietnam and Malaysia and Singapore and Thailand, and Cambodia are all on lockdown now and battling new outbreaks of this Indian variant. It's extremely contagious, at least 60% more contagious than the British variant, which of course has been extremely contagious and has, been a real problem in India and in much of Europe and in, here in the United States. It's even more contagious than that. So, that's going to get to the shores of the United States at some point, and we're going to be all opened up and people are going to be ignoring, you know, everything that we've learned over the last years about how to battle the pandemic. I don't think it's over by a long shot. I think we're going to have another wave.
Fifth wave.
Or sixth or seventh. God help us.
Sure.
You know, it's going to hit at some point, either this summer or this fall. And, you know, now is not the time to relax, I don't think, you know. And unfortunately, my skepticism has been proven out over and over again in the course of this pandemic. I mean, every time we have seen countries try and open things up and get their economy back to normal and all the other rhetoric you hear from elected officials, they've gotten another wave. Because it's a very resilient virus that does not care about politics and does not care about people's impatience and desire. It loves people's desire to socialize. That's how it spreads.
Well, as long as we continue to have leadership like that coming from Jay Inslee, who appears to be lining himself as up for representing the, you know, restaurant and hotel industry after his, you know, he leaves office.
We had a very mixed reaction from different states because, of course, the CDC's guidance is still just that, guidance. It's up to states to actually enact it. So a number of states, including Washington State, immediately dropped their mask mandates. You know, Inslee, at his press conference on Thursday announcing this, ostentatiously took his mask off, which is the first time he's been without a mask at a press conference in over a year. But you had other states like New York and Connecticut, New Jersey, North Carolina, Massachusetts, that Virginia, that said, well, we're going to look at the guidance, we're going to look at the data, and we're going to make up our own minds, but we're going to take our time with it. California took that approach as well. So Inslee did not have to drop the mask mandate immediately, but he chose to do so. And I think that personally, I think that was a huge mistake. What I've been telling people is that I think the medical science is sound on how the virus spreads. We know at this point that, you know, outdoor activity is by and large okay, that vaccinated people do not spread fully vaccinated people. That's 2 weeks after your second shot. Do not spread the virus. If they may get the virus, but it's very, it's very unlikely that you will get a serious case of it or you'll be hospitalized. So from a medical standpoint, it may be sound advice from the CDC, but the problem is that it's bad public health messaging because it encourages people to relax. And the meta narrative is that the pandemic is over, that you can go back doing whatever you want to do. And we can't. There's still, 250 new cases a day in King County. I might feel comfortable. We were down under 100 cases a day consistently last summer. So we're 2.5 times where we were last summer. The pandemic is not over. People are still getting it. People are getting seriously ill from it. People are dying from it. And it's primarily people under the age of 40 at this point, because people over the age of 40, by and large, are getting vaccinated. So it's people who want to go out and party, which is, the younger set. So, it is not the time to relax. It is not the time to take things for granted or go back to quote-unquote normal.
Do you happen to have numbers for number or percentage of people vaccinated in Washington State, King County?
I don't have it at the county level. I could have looked that up if I had known you were going to ask it.
That's the only kind of questions I like to ask.
Yeah, exactly. Just go ahead and make me look bad. Statewide, it's about 50%. Statewide, it's about 50%. And Oregon, for example, took the tack of, we're going to drop the mask mandate as soon as we get to 70% statewide being fully vaccinated, which is kind of a smart way to do it, because that is the point at which herd immunity supposedly kicks in, the minimum point anyway. But we're not waiting for that. And, the problem with relying on people who haven't been vaccinated to get vaccinated as an incentive is you've got an entire anti-vax movement out there that is built on a foundation of lying. So why wouldn't they lie about this, particularly when it's a chance to stick it to the man, which is the other ideology behind the anti-vaccine movement, is distrust of government. So it seems like a recipe for disaster, honestly. And the nicest thing I can say is it's a very optimistic read on human nature and people being willing to do the right thing for their community. I don't think that's the country we live in, sad to say, particularly after 4 years of Trump. Yeah. We should have already gotten plenty of evidence to the contrary.
Anything else on
COVID? No, lots of other things happened this week. We should probably get to them.
Okay. Let's starting with Liz Cheney.
Yeah. Well, there was a constellation of stories this week that demonstrated just how certifiable the modern Republican Party is. The big political story of the week, which everybody was obsessing over in national media, was the removal of Liz Cheney from the leadership of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives and her replacement. So now the top four people in the Republican Party leadership in the House of Representatives all voted not to certify the election last January. In other words, claiming that Trump actually won, which is factually not the case, obviously. It's delusional. The Republican Party right now is not only built on a big lie, but it is actively purging people who won't sign off on the big lie. And, Liz Cheney is an old school Republican. She's very conservative. I don't agree with her on much, but her speech this week in which she said that, loyalty to Donald Trump, cannot coexist with democracy. This is a threat to the Constitution. This is a threat to democracy. And she's absolutely right about that. She is now an apostate within the Republican Party because of that. There was a threat by a number of former Republican elected officials to launch a third party initiative this week. That kind of didn't happen. I didn't hear anything about that. The announcement was supposed to be on Thursday. So I don't know what's going on with that, but I really don't think it will amount to much. This is the modern Republican Party. And there were a number of other stories this week that told you what the modern Republicans stand for or don't stand for. There was the video that was released of the woman who's CEO of the Heritage Foundation, their political arm, their PAC, actively bragging that we've been writing voter suppression legislation and feeding it to the states. We wrote it for Arizona. We wrote it for Georgia. This is how Republicans can win. It can win by making sure that Democrats can't vote. So we sent expert witnesses to Georgia. We offered testimony, blah, blah, blah. And this was, secretly taped in a meeting with this woman, the CEO, and major donors to the Heritage Foundation's PAC, where she was actively bragging. This is what they're doing. It's very similar to an ALEC-like initiative where, you know, cookie-cutter legislation is being spoon-fed to Republican legislators, and a number of states now have passed these voter suppression packages, Georgia, Arizona, Iowa, Montana, states all over the country that are taking them up. Texas is very close to passing it, and that will be a big deal, of course, since it's the second largest state by population in the country, and demographically it's a few years behind Georgia in terms of all of its major cities are now democratically run. Probably close to half the population now leans Democrat. It's becoming a purple state. The only way Republicans can hang on to power long term is by making sure that people can't vote. And that really is the only unifying theme for Republicans, that and fealty to Donald Trump. They don't actually have any conservative principles anymore. Their principle primarily is opposition to democracy. And wanting their God Emperor, and yes, that is a term that you see on right wing sites these days. We supposedly founded this country to get rid of a king, and now people want a king again. It's very, very disturbing, and the threat to democracy is not over, not by a long shot. So there was that story. That was great fun. Another interesting story, kind of a bombshell that got buried on Wednesday in the New York Times, buried by Liz Cheney and then all the CDC news on Thursday, was an investigative piece that discovered that the Trump administration was paying a British ex-spy to train volunteers from Project Veritas, which is this, right-wing effort that for the last decade plus has been doctoring videos to try and make people on the left look bad. They took down Acorn, for example, the infamous pimp video. And they've tried somewhat incompetently ever since to bring down left-leaning elected officials, and usually it gets exposed very quickly because they're not very competent. So they had this spy come in and try and train them to entrap people within the government who they thought were not sufficiently loyal to Donald Trump. And this was taxpayer money that was being used to do this. This is incredibly Stalinesque, and it should really alarm anybody that has any remaining doubts about what Trump stood for, that he made public service the test of whether you are worthy for public service is whether you are loyal to the dear leader or not. These are the kind of purges that Stalin became known for. And Mao and various other authoritarian leaders over the years, because this is how authoritarian leaders work. And of course, Trump was learning and taking notes for the last, several years from the very best in Vladimir Putin. So this was very, very disturbing, stuff. And it was a story that did not get nearly enough attention, in my opinion.
Well, and it even involves Eric Prince. And
yes, Prince was involved in this nonsense
Blackwater.
Too. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, and of course, his sister Betsy DeVos was in the Trump cabinet for 4 years. One of the few people who lasted all 4 years, along with Ben Carson.
Eric Prince, who runs one of the I don't know if it's one of the largest, but a very large mercenary.
He is one of the primary sponsors of mercenaries around the world, and he's gotten very rich off of it. Not that his family wasn't wealthy already, but he's gotten even wealthier off of it. Trafficking in human misery, which seems to be a running theme within the Trump orbit. But yeah, he was involved in this also. And, I would encourage people to go back and find that story. Because it's a doozy. Hmm. I was surprised that it did not get more media attention than it did.
Yeah, well,
I think to some extent people are burned out on Trump administration scandals, but there's going to be a lot more that comes out because it was easily the most corrupt administration in American history. Is the kind of kleptocracy that is more commonly associated with sub-Saharan African countries, or modern Russia, for example. More is going to come out, no question.
All right. Moving on, developments this week.
I'm looking forward to the Giuliani indictment. Because the Giuliani is not just being investigated for Ukraine, he's vulnerable on taxes the same way that Manafort was, because he was going to Ukraine not just to benefit Trump but to benefit himself. He was selling himself as attorney to the president. I have the ear of the president. You should hire me as a consultant. Blah blah blah, and he was getting a lot of money that way, allegedly. They're investigating all that, and that takes time to untangle. But I think he's in a lot of legal trouble. Also, in way more legal trouble this week is Matt Gaetz, one of the chief apologists for Donald Trump, who's made a name for himself in the House of Representatives in only 4 short years. By being one of Trump's most obsequious and vocal defenders. He's been investigated for potential interstate child trafficking of a minor. And his confederate in that, who had been indicted last summer, who texts have been published showing that he was basically helping service Gaetz with very young and in some cases underage women. A guy named Joel Greenberg, who is a former local official in Seminole County, Florida, he pleaded guilty yesterday and agreed to a plea deal with the feds. He pleaded guilty to, among other things, interstate trafficking of a minor, which is a very serious offense. It carries a minimum 10-year prison sentence. And he was the person who was allegedly feeding Gaetz these women. In at least one case, allegedly a minor. And you know what? It doesn't matter whether they thought she was of age or not. In fact, one of the things that Greenberg pleaded guilty to was creating fake IDs for some of these women. So they knew that they were underage and had to try and get them into bars and all the rest of it. I think Matt Gaetz is in a lot of trouble. Fortunately, he has a bright future as a martyr in the modern GOP as soon as he gets out of prison. He can go on tours speaking about, how he was wronged and how Donald Trump is God. Of course, the speaking venues probably can't be anywhere near a school because he'll be a licensed sex predator. Predation, sexual and otherwise, seems to be a running theme in the modern GOP. It's very alarming and very sad. And it's the sort of thing that goes along with an authoritarian mindset and that level of entitlement. I think there's a reason these scandals keep happening to elected officials among in the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well.
And of course, you know, deep seated misogyny. That's also a feature, along with the racism.
Yeah. Moving on, Colonial Pipeline.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because that also is related to Russia. Colonial Pipeline is the largest single pipeline in the United States. I believe it's owned by Koch Industries. And it supplies much of the eastern seaboard with its oil. It was hacked this week in a ransomware attack by what was described in US media as Russian criminal gangs. Now, of course, Russian criminal gangs don't operate in Russia without the tacit and probably explicit permission of the Putin government and the Russian mob. And Putin knows perfectly well the first rule of mobs, which is that you allow people to take their cut, but you got to take your cut too. And so these gangs, they are criminal gangs, they do exist, but they don't operate within Russia. They only operate internationally. And, you know, do you happen to know the passwords and the control points and all the rest of it of that particular pipeline? I don't, and I don't know how I would go about finding out. But an intelligence agency does. That's what intelligence agencies do. And, you know, Russia has already demonstrated, you may remember in, I believe, 2017 or 2018, in an attack on a utility in Vermont, that it has the capacity to attack the electrical grid and the energy sector in the United States. So Russian intelligence has that information. That is most likely where this quote-unquote criminal gang got it. This was a Russian state operation, you know, with one level of deniability. So once again, we have Russia attacking the United States, and it is incumbent on the Biden administration to respond appropriately, you know, with additional sanctions or diplomatic moves. You know, fortunately, I think that will happen, unlike the last administration, which will not simply get on the phone of Vladimir Putin and say, attaboy, keep doing it. The attack on the pipeline has resulted in gas shortages across the southeastern U.S. in particular. We've seen some hoarding of gas and higher prices and all the rest of that. The pipeline is operational now. It took 6 days to get back to operational. And we found out that Colonial Pipeline did, in fact, pay something like $5 million in ransom to this gang in order to get their systems unlocked. But they still – it was literally faster to restore their systems using their backups than it was to unlock it, because the restoration was already underway. But it really does underscore the need for investment in infrastructure, because this is infrastructure just as much as roads and bridges are. In the modern U.S., IT systems are critical infrastructure. And security for IT systems is critical infrastructure, and that needs to be better funded. Businesses need to put more money into it, and the government definitely needs to put more money into it. You know, some of the antiquated systems, I mean, we saw, for instance, with LNI where, you know, what was it, a Nigerian gang that had a huge data breach, in early 2020 with LNI, and that delayed a lot of people getting their unemployment benefits. The state was able to get its money back. But the system was vulnerable in the first place because it was a relatively antiquated software. Governments need to be able to update their software with modern protections against things like ransomware. And this is something that the Biden administration is trying to fund, and that once again Republicans in the Senate, in particular, are blocking. So as they are blocking voter rights legislation, as they are blocking police reform, they're blocking all kinds of legislation that would address really crises issues in the United States right now. So. We've got one party that's trying to govern, however imperfectly, and another that is trying to block government.
Well, part of the problem, too, is that this infrastructure oftentimes, most of the time, is owned by private for-profit corporations that consciously choose not to invest money in safety features. Which is essentially
or the staff that can implement them. Yeah.
So and
or this, they don't pay them enough. Yeah.
Yeah. And this issue specific with tech and cybersecurity has been known and talked about for at least 25 years, as long as we've been doing this. And and everybody saw this coming.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Saying so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Throw that in. Okay. Well, catching up on my notes.
Yeah.
A reversal on the Trump ban on trans healthcare protections.
Yeah, this was another story that got buried this week. On Monday, HHS announced that the Trump era ban on protections for healthcare for trans people has been reversed. That those protections are now being reinstated. That's a tremendous victory for trans rights, and it comes at the federal level. The previous Obama era protections, protections against discrimination against trans people for healthcare services was abolished under Trump. That has now been reinstated again under Biden. So that's very good news. Conservatives can go cry all they want, but a lot of these state level bills that we're seeing in Republican led states that discriminate against trans people, those are now going to be illegal under federal law.
All right. Okay. And this last week, shootings that occurred?
Yeah. Well, this is our weekly update. there was another mass shooting on Sunday night. This was Saturday night. I'm sorry, last week. Into Sunday morning in Colorado Springs, six people died at a birthday party, I believe. And again, these shootings have become so routine that this was barely national news. It was major local news in Colorado, but that was about it. There have been something like 200 mass shootings so far this year, in the United States, and no other country in the world has this problem. But we do. And that once again is something that, needs legislation that is not happening at the congressional level.
Okay. Let's, move on to international and talk about what's going on in Gaza.
Yeah. There's a lot of international news this week. First of all, we talked last week about the standoff in East Jerusalem, where Israeli quote unquote settlers, and that is a term that I despise because it masks the fact that these people are not settling, they are stealing, because there's already people living on that land and they're displacing those people in order to live there. So East Jerusalem, which has been controlled by Palestinians, since 1967, their settlers are trying to move into some of that real estate, which is very lucrative. And of course, if you've ever been to Israel, everything is very close together. It is a geographically small country. So all these places are very, very close together. So the Israeli Supreme Court was going to rule this week on whether those settlers could in fact displace Palestinians, using the rationale that, well, Jews historically lived there before 1948. Well, if you go back far enough, I'm sure that's the case, because the area's been settled for, you know, thousands of years. You know, everybody's lived everywhere at some point. So we saw some clashes last week in East Jerusalem and between Palestinians and Israelis, Israeli government and Israeli settlers. We saw vigilantes literally lynching Palestinians. So you had this, and that escalated with retaliatory measures by the Israeli government, and then Hamas started firing rockets into Israel. And that is what turned Gaza into a target. And we have seen a steady barrage of airstrikes over the last several days that has been steadily escalating. Yesterday into last evening, we saw a building destroyed that had a number of children in it. We saw destruction of a building that had the international media housed there, and something like 137 Palestinians have died so far. Just in the last 24 hours, more Palestinians have died than have died from Palestinian rockets into Israel over the last 20 years. So that gives you an idea of the disproportionality of the violence. The U.S. media, as usual, has been terrible in covering this conflict. You know, the best you're getting from most of these outlets is, well, both sides are doing it. Hamas is firing rockets and Israel is firing rockets. And that doesn't, and, you know, you hear about Israeli casualties, but not Palestinian casualties. It is masking the fact that the Israeli violence is much, much more disproportionate and is intentionally targeting civilians, is intentionally targeting media, is intentionally targeting, you know, targets that are considered war crimes under international law. Of course, the United States is supplying a lot of these rockets and a lot of these munitions, because it always does.
Like the F-16s that are bombing.
Exactly. So, you know, this is escalating. We're seeing a lot of demonstrations scheduled for today around the country and around the world in solidarity with Palestine. We have one that we'll get to at the end of the program in events for tomorrow. 2 o'clock Westlake, spoiler alert. You know, this is something that, that is threatening to spiral. I mean, it's already spiraled out of control. It could get much worse over the next few days. So it's something that deserves a lot of international attention. And, you know, Israel clearly does not care what the rest of the world thinks as it operates on this. Netanyahu's government has said that, you know, basically they're gonna destroy Palestinians' capacity to resist, which, you know, is probably not going to happen, not unless you kill all the Palestinians, which I'm sure has been suggested in the Netanyahu government. But it is a very, very worrisome development. So something to keep an eye on.
And the Biden administration and the U.S. could stop this, you know, in an hour if they chose to.
Joe Biden has a long history of support for Israel, and he's been supportive of Israel in his comments so far. That is not a surprise, unfortunately. You know, apologies for Israel's war crimes are a bipartisan affair and have been for decades in the United States government, really since Israel's inception. You know, it's almost the one article of faith that people in both parties seem to have to sign on to for some reason. There have been very few critics, and Seattle's Pramila Jayapal has been one of them, of what Israel has been doing. So thank you to Representative Jayapal, and I wish there were more like her in Congress. because Congress controls the purse strings for all these arms sales and all the military aid that goes to Israel, which is still by far the largest recipient of such aid in the world.
And this week, the UN Security Council tried to pass a resolution to stop this, and the United States was the sole vote against.
That is correct.
That is a
familiar position for the United States, being the sole vote on the Security Council for whatever Israel is doing,
yes.
no matter how bad its depredations.
That's the default position, it appears.
Pretty much, yep.
Okay. Well, clearly we're going to be talking about this more next week, too.
Probably, yes.
Colombia.
Yeah. Israel sort of bumped Colombia from the news this week because U.S. media can only handle one international crisis at a time. But Colombia today is going into its third week of protests against the government there. This started as a protest of a tax reform plan by the right-wing government in Colombia, which has since been withdrawn to basically tax staples at a higher rate in a country that's been decimated by the pandemic that was already quite poor. It has morphed into a broader set of protests against the government, against government plan to reform healthcare to make it less give less access to ordinary people, against the right wing government, against the violence that the police in Colombia have used to respond to these protests. Something like 47 people have died so far in these protests over the last 2 weeks. The city of Cali in western Colombia seems to be the epicenter of this. A large part of central Cali is now an autonomous zone. That will sound familiar. They took over a police station and turned it into a people's library. I mean, it really is a remarkable series of protests. Much of central Cali now is barricaded off by protesters. And police have not been able to breach those barricades. This is the sort of level of protests that have been going on in Colombia, and the right-wing government there, of course, has again enjoyed American support. The police there, thanks to the war on drugs, have all had American training and American munitions, and they're using this now against citizens of their own country. So this, again, is a story that we need to keep an eye on. There is a Colombian community in the Seattle area that has been supportive of these protests. Best wishes. It's the sort of thing that, we can learn from these tactics as well.
And by 47 people died, you mean killed?
Killed, yes. By police, by gunfire.
Police and paramilitary.
Yes, that's the other thing there have been these vigilante paramilitary groups that have been targeting protesters as well. And of course, Colombia had a peace accord with its long-running civil war only in 2016, and the paramilitaries were a feature of that war. So all those people with all those guns are still around, and they still probably have those weapons. So that's one of the concerns with these protests, is that it may rekindle the civil war in Colombia, which would be tragic. But that is a fear.
Well, we're just about out of time. Again, there's an event tomorrow.
Tomorrow at 2:00 at Westlake Park, 4th and Pine in downtown Seattle, in solidarity with the people of Palestine, calling on Israel to cease fire with its airstrikes, and on the United States to condemn Israel and to provide humanitarian aid to the Palestinians who desperately need it right now. You've got a lot of Palestinians who don't have a place to live right now because, again, the Israelis have been targeting residential neighborhoods and claiming that, Hamas is using them as a shield for launching its rockets, which there's not a lot of evidence for, at least not evidence in the West, and part of it is that international media doesn't have a lot of access to these areas because they're under fire, and because their headquarters in Gaza again were taken out by rocket fire last night. So
probably from an US F-16.
That is correct. So 2 o'clock tomorrow, Westlake, be there.
And by tomorrow, we mean Sunday the 16th.
Yes, let's be clear about that. Yes. Sunday the
16th.
Yes. And if you're listening to this on Monday, well, you missed out, but you can still be supportive.